I always like it when students and others bring in articles and things relevant to the lecture topics. And Professor Gary Fick brought in a copy of a Wendell Berry article, and I wanted just to read one paragraph from it. It's quite relevant to some of the things that we've been talking about. This is in Berry's Recollected Essays, his essay, Discipline and Hope. He says in this paragraph, "I do not know how exact a case might be made, but it seems to me that there is an historical parallel in white American history between the treatment of the land and the treatment of women. The frontier, for instance, was notoriously exploitative of both, and I believe for largely the same reasons. Many of the early farmers seem to have worn out farms and wives with equal regardlessness, interested in both mainly for what they would produce, crops and dollars, labor and sons. They clamored upon their fields and upon their wives, struggling for an economic foothold, the having and holding that cannot come until both fields and wives are properly cherished. And today there seems to me a distinct connection between our nomadism, our social mobility, and the nearly universal disintegration of marriage and families." I thought that was an interesting comment. Even when you don't fully agree with Berry, I usually do agree with him, actually. His writings are almost always stimulating and really get us thinking about some of these important issues. Let's see. Any announcements? I think we're okay. I realized as I worked on the Niebuhr reading last night. Yes, Shannon? We haven't. I need to talk, Rob, with you about that. They will meet at the same time. We will cover them. So I'm not sure just how we'll do that. But there will be the regular sections tomorrow and Friday. And also the writing section on Monday. He's not getting back till Tuesday. I'll be covering the writing section on Monday. So all of those will be as usual. The only thing we're going to do is combine these two sections at 11:15 today. Good. As I worked on the Galatians text and the Niebuhr reading, I realized how extraordinarily difficult it is to get into the mindset of an earlier generation, not just an earlier generation, but really going back some 2,000 years, or as we did in the text from Deuteronomy, for instance, going back much further than that. It's extraordinarily difficult in some ways to realize, on the one hand, how much humans are the same, and on the other hand, how different they are in different contexts and within different cultural settings. And I realized, in one sense, how utterly preposterous this course is. You're reading a variety of texts, some of which must sound like they come from some other planet, because you're really reading a great variety of material. And some of it is, if you don't have the background, just extremely difficult to get into. I'd like to give you just a little of the background and also draw a few connections with earlier lectures. I think in order to understand Galatians, for instance, and I focus on Galatians, I could equally well have chosen the book of Romans, because these two letters of Paul have had an utterly formative influence in Western culture. Probably at least as important, in fact, I would say in some respects more important than the Socratic dialogues and the writings of Plato and Aristotle. They've been utterly formative in the shaping of Western culture. One thing that may be helpful in understanding Galatians is to talk just very briefly about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. If you go back, say, to maybe Moses and the time of the Exodus, and then if you take this as, say, the exile in the 6th century before the current era, and then if you go on towards the future. What happened from the time of the Babylonian exile on in Judaism is that there was some development of different Jewish sects or different ways of understanding Judaism. You had on the one hand the gradual emergence of this is not really in scale. This would be a very long period and this would be a shorter period. Say a Pharisaic Judaism. One R or twos. My spelling is one. It's getting awful as I get older. The gradual emergence of Pharisaic Judaism. You had, say, the emergence of the Sadducees as another Jewish sect. They, for instance, in contrast to the Pharisees, did not believe in resurrection and life to come in the way the Pharisees did. You had the rather strange sect, the Essenes, that lived down near the Dead Sea and wrote the famous Dead Sea Scrolls that were discovered back in the 1940s. You had the political activists, the Zealots, emerging. And of these groups, the Essenes were pretty decisively stamped out by the Romans in about AD 70. The Sadducees also suffered a great deal of diminution at that time, survived in part until AD 135. The Zealots that were political activists, they were rather ruthlessly stamped out. It was mainly Pharisaic Judaism that survived into gradually developed into modern rabbinic Judaism. But this would not give us a complete picture, because drawing to some extent on all of these, although mainly from Pharisaic Judaism and perhaps somewhat from the Essenes, less so from the Zealots and Sadducees, you had the emergence of another form of Judaism, which would, I think, historically rightly be called Christian Judaism, or some perhaps Messianic Judaism, whatever. Now, I think, and again, this is not, if this time scale were right, Moses would have to be way over on the left-hand side. I describe it this way because all of the earliest Christians were Jews, the very earliest generation, and they all thought of themselves as Jews. They did not think of themselves as starting a new religion. They were Jews who came to believe that the long-awaited Messiah was Jesus of Nazareth. And it was only as you get on somewhat later into the middle of the first century of the Christian era, and then particularly as you go on into the latter part of that first century, and much, much more so in the second and third century, that Christians are mainly from among the non-Jews or the Gentiles. But the earliest generation of Christians were Jews, and they thought of themselves as Jews. Now, I mention this because a lot of the argument that you find in the book of Galatians is really a Jewish dialogue. It's a dialogue between mainly Pharisaic Jews, although at that time there would have still been some input from the Sadducees and so on, a dialogue between, say, Pharisaic Jews and Christian Jews, Jews who recognize Jesus as the Messiah. And that puts the dialogue in quite a different context. I think even though Paul, as a Jew, says some very harsh things about fellow Jews, this cannot be taken as an anti-Semitic text because it's a quarrel among Jews. It's a family quarrel that is a fairly important quarrel. This is extremely important to keep in mind, this kind of way of reframing the question. Now, one of the issues, and this is reflected in the book of Galatians, that both Jews and later Christians faced was the issue that is sometimes referred to as legalism. This would tie back to the earlier lectures I gave on the indicative preceding the imperative. That is, the interpretation I gave of the text from Deuteronomy and Joshua, I argue that at least in one strand of Judaism, the covenant is unconditional, and it clearly stresses that God's deliverance, God's love, God's mercy is prior to the ethical response. There is also in the Jewish scriptures a more conditional form of the covenant. But this, these texts that I pointed to, I found significant because they very consistently at these critical moments in Jewish history, the harvest festival, the passing on of the power from one generation to the next, and the passing on of traditions from father to son, in each of these cases, in explanation of what was happening, there was simply a story told of the Exodus. And thus it's also not surprising that in Judaism until this day, that the Exodus plays a very, very central role in the Passover and so on, in the whole Jewish story. Indicative precedes imperative. And you'll recall that I tried a kind of reinterpretation of the Decalogue, arguing that you really can't understand the Decalogue adequately unless you see it in light of the preface. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, and so on. I argued that the Decalogue, in one sense then, is not simply a legalistic code. If you follow the Decalogue, you'll be a good Jew. But the Decalogue is the kind of life that is possible for those who experience God's deliverance. I argued even that if you wanted to push this as far as you could see the Decalogue almost as a kind of Magna Carta. This is a statement of freedom. It's possible to live this way because you don't have to secure your own future on your own. You don't have to steal and commit adultery and slander and so on because your life isn't based on those things. It's based on God's deliverance. The indicative precedes the imperative. Now, what I'm going to suggest in Galatians is you have the same pattern, but within a very different framework. And in both Judaism and Christianity at various periods, you have the development of what is sometimes called legalism. That is, both Jews and Christians at different times have lost sight of the fact that gospel precedes law, the indicative, the imperative, and have mistakenly, I think, in terms of the heart of these traditions, come to believe that it is through one's good works, through one's ethical behavior, through one's keeping the law, the Torah, that one impresses God, that this is the way you earn God's love, is by being a good person, being a law-abiding person, keeping all the legal code, and so on. And at various periods, this has been understandable. It was particularly understandable, I think, in the period after the Babylonian captivity of the Jews, because the temple was destroyed. They had no homeland. They were fugitives, resident aliens in another country. And the question arose, who is a Jew? You couldn't say easily a Jew is somebody who worships at the temple. You couldn't say a Jew is someone who lives in the area of Palestine, roughly, you know, because they didn't have a homeland. Increasingly and understandably, that question came to be answered. A Jew is one who keeps the law. A Jew is one who keeps Torah. And I think to some degree, never completely, of course, that pushed Judaism in the direction of a kind of legalism. And Jesus's ministry, so to speak, his criticism of his fellow Jews, was that they had become very, very legalistic and forgot that it is God's love and mercy and God's deliverance that is fundamental for the life of the Jew. And I would argue that precisely that same type of dynamic has happened at various periods in Christian history. The Protestant Reformation really was a kind of inner Christian quarrel, family quarrel, about the problem of legalism. Do you basically earn God's love through your good works and the purchase of indulgences and so on, or is it God's love that is prior? So that is absolutely basic in the understanding of this writing. Another tie-in with one of the earlier lectures would be the tie-in with the concept of freedom. It's very, very difficult for us today to understand, as I indicated in an earlier lecture, how odd our current situation is of the last few hundred years, especially the last 50 or 100 years, to see ethics almost totally in terms of choice and decisions. This is a very, very strange phenomenon, really growing out of the Enlightenment and out of the rise of modern political liberalism, classic liberalism in the sense that both Republicans and Democrats are liberals, that tended to view man, human beings, in terms of choice, autonomy, reason in the service of passion or desire. Reason is what helps you get what basically you just want. And this emphasis on choice, which also may be a kind of epiphenomenon in relation to a market economy. The whole market economy sees us as consumers and choosers. We have all this wonderful array of possibilities in consumer goods and where we vacation and so on, and increasingly have seen the moral life in terms of decision-making and choice rather than, as the ancients tended to, in terms of integrity, character, or in terms of aligning your life, as Iris Murdoch argues in various of her philosophical essays, in terms of aligning your life with the good and the beautiful and the true, or within a, say, a Jewish or Christian framework in terms of the will of God. The older concept of freedom was that freedom is that state that results when you stop worshiping yourself, when you stop worshiping false gods like money and power and sex and success and fame, and start worshiping the true God, or in Murdoch's terms, writing as more or less an atheist, when you start living your life in terms of the good and the beautiful and the true. So as we shall see when we look at Galatians, Murdoch talks about the need of unselfing. She says the self is too small and uninteresting an object to deserve all the attention we give it. Paul, in Galatians, talks about being crucified with Christ, dying and being born into a new kind of life, the life of the Spirit. And as I pointed out, this theme of death and resurrection is, or death and rebirth, really is quite common in various religious traditions. Now, I mention this because for both Judaism and Christianity, in contrast to modern liberal political and ethical thinking, again, liberal in the classical sense, the large L, not liberal with a small L, in contrast to the way much of this is done today, that ethics is about choice and decision making, these traditions very, very much focus on what is the world like? Who are you? What's nature? What is the world like? And how do you fit in to the world about you? And the argument that I think the ancient Hebrews were making, and later a theme that runs through Judaism, and in some ways is even more prominent in Christianity, the argument that is made about the nature of the world, as in different ways in other religious traditions, look at how the Taoists talk about the Tao. The argument being made is that the world is basically a trustworthy place where the fundamental reality is not the need to justify yourself or prove your own worth through your power and fame and consumption and your achievements. You don't have to prove your worth to yourself or to your neighbor or to God. Because the way the world is, as the ancient Jews saw it and as the Christians saw it, is the world is trustworthy, and it starts basically with yes rather than with no or maybe. That is, it is precisely within these traditions, God's love, God's mercy, God's deliverance, which makes it possible for human life to flourish. And thus, as I have argued the relevance of this, one, at least theoretically, no longer has to try to prove his own worth through consumption and power and control and domination of other people and of nature and the natural environment. At least theoretically, those would be wrong ways to act. And futile ways to act, they're simply not necessary. In terms of the interpretation I gave of the Decalogue, you don't have to murder and slander and steal and commit adultery because that's not where life is to be found. You don't have to have big houses and huge cars, powerful cars and vacations in exotic places because at the deepest level, that's not what human life is all about. That's how I want to tie in both the Deuteronomy texts and the Galatian texts to the larger themes. Now, what's going on in the church in Galatia is fairly straightforward, and I think it's reasonably intelligible if we see it within that context. The earliest generation of Christians were all Jews. And they just, without much thought about the matter, just as a matter of course, continued to keep the Jewish law. The Jewish law regarding circumcision and ritual washings and so on. That really wasn't a big issue. That's who they were. They were Jews. And even though they had come to believe in Jesus Christ as the Savior, as the Messiah, it was just understandable that they would continue to live this way. That's who they were. But what happened is that in churches like the church in Antioch and other churches through Asia Minor and so on, towards the middle of the century, there began to be an increasing number of Gentile converts. That is, people who were not Jews, but who came in association with these Jewish Christians and were attracted to this teaching and became followers of Jesus, just as the Jewish believers had done. The problem, however, was that for these Gentile converts, it wasn't at all obvious that they ought to keep the law. They weren't used to circumcision and all the food laws, and it was a very, very elaborate system. But some of the Jewish Christians thought they ought to keep the law if they wanted really to be full-fledged Christians. And there was a lot of controversy. And at first, Peter, the Apostle Peter, sometimes referred to here as Cephas, has two names, agreed that the Gentile converts would not have to keep the Jewish ritual law, would not have to be circumcised. And but later, he had pressure from the more conservative, traditional Jewish Christians in Jerusalem who thought that the Gentile converts ought to have to keep the law if they wanted to be followers of Jesus. And there was a real uproar about this. Paul takes the position that it all depends on why and for what reasons you keep the law. He basically continues to follow the law himself and agrees that this is just natural and normal and an okay thing for the Jewish Christians. But he senses that there is pressure now on the Gentile Christians to keep the law in order to be full-fledged followers of Jesus, in order to have salvation or in order to be justified or in order to be fully within the Christian community. And Paul is troubled by this because he argues that this really fails to realize the radical nature of the Christian gospel. Just like for the ancient Jews, I argued, you didn't become a Jew by keeping the Decalogue. You kept the Decalogue because you had already experienced God's love and mercy and already were a Jew. Actually, that was before the time the term Jew was used, a Hebrew. So Paul argued that to now begin to infer that the Gentile Christians have to start keeping the ritual law, be circumcised, keep the food laws and so on, eat kosher, in order to be a follower of Jesus, that somehow misses the radical quality of God's love, which Paul believes is reflected in the Christian gospel. Paul, as the early church gradually does, begins to see Jesus more and more in terms of God's revelation, and indeed stronger than that, as God incarnate, God making himself known, as Paul says, in the flesh, in human form. And he sees the death, the passion and death of Jesus as God in Christ taking human suffering into his own being and thus atoning and redeeming human beings, very much as a kind of elaboration of the Jewish idea of sacrifice related to the Day of Atonement and so on. Paul sees Jesus as the quintessential sacrifice. And he sees through this that God takes human pain and suffering and guilt into his own being. And it is this act of God in Christ which constitutes the possibility of a new deliverance. Just as God delivered the ancient Hebrews from slavery in Egypt, so Paul argues God delivers through Jesus Christ his people from slavery to sin. But what troubles Paul then is that if you try to mix this up with a kind of legalism, if you try to say, well, you also have to keep the law in order to be saved, you have some real problems. I think with that framework, it becomes much easier to see what is going on. Paul says that when you really think about it, it's not even even for the Jewish Christians, it's not the fact that they keep the law that has anything to do with their salvation. It's the fact that Christ died for them. But they continue to keep the law simply as a matter of course, because that's how they grew up and that's the way life normally seems. So the same actions have very, very different meaning. In chapter 5, for instance, he starts out, he says in verse 1, for freedom, and that's one of the key terms that I've been talking about in recent weeks, for freedom Christ has set us free. Stand fast, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. He says, now I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, this is the Gentiles, Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is bound to keep the whole law. You are severed from Christ. You who would be justified by the law, you have fallen away from grace. Now, why does he say that? He says, if you're going to believe that you have to justify yourself, you better not stop just with circumcision. You better keep the whole law. If you choose the principle of self-justification, you'd better do the whole thing so you get it right. But he says, if you do that, then you've fallen away from grace. He says, for through the Spirit, by faith, we wait for the hope of righteousness. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision is of any avail, but faith working through love. What does he mean? What he means is that ultimately, keeping the Jewish law or not keeping it is not what the game is really all about. That what really is going on is the love and mercy and graciousness of God, not keeping the law. And that's true for the Jews who keep the law, the Jewish Christians, as well as for the Gentiles, whom he argues should not have to keep the law. And then he concludes this a little later. He says, "For you were called to freedom, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh." Flesh here means not body, but the old nature, the old man. "But through love be servants of one another, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word." And this is a biblical quote from the Jewish scripture, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Now, I see this as a very, very radical theme that has been utterly constitutive in some ways in Western culture. Western culture has often become very legalistic. It certainly is a culture that has been very materialistic in some ways. But it seems to me, at least in principle, the idea that we do not have to justify ourselves, we do not have to prove our worth, is, at least in principle, an extraordinarily liberating view. That you are valuable, you are worthwhile, your life is okay, not because of your levels of power, consumption, fame, and so on, but basically because God loves you within this tradition. And it is that love which liberates you to live differently. And this is why, in terms of environmental ethics within this tradition, and that's what we're trying to do here, is to see how, spend a couple weeks seeing how Jews and Christians would handle some of these issues. Within this tradition, it becomes very obvious that rules and principles are penultimate, they're secondary, they're not primary. Rules and principles, as I see them, are what I would call middle axioms. They're guidelines, they're extremely useful, so individuals don't have to constantly be reinventing the wheel themselves. You don't have to make lots of mistakes. You can learn from your ancestors, from those who have made the mistakes before you. You can learn from history. But it is not the rules and principles that are fundamental in ethics. I think ethics, as I've said many times, fundamentally grows out of what you think the world is like. That's why I assign in this class that little piece by Harvey Cox, Playboy's Doctrine of Male? It's a nice example. If you think of women, if men think of women basically as playthings, as one more consumer commodity, they will treat them that way. If we think of nature as something that has only utilitarian or instrumental value, we will treat it that way. And thus, what you think the world is like is utterly important in terms of how you live and how you treat other people. Let me pause here for a moment and see if this is making any sense. Let me get some feedback from you. It's extraordinarily difficult to get into ancient texts like this and make any sense out of them. Yes?
I kind of see the connection that you're trying to make between, for example, Jewish laws and between that and using things for material purposes
mm-hmm.
and for utilitarian purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not exactly sure where that comes in because, for example, in Jewish law, a lot of the laws are toward being humble and toward mm-hmm. not using things and toward respecting
mm-hmm.
in general and thinking things in terms of God.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering how that really...
Well,
how you see that.
Okay. I think the same principle really would apply, that it isn't somehow by keeping these kinds of laws that you mentioned. Some of them are absolutely marvelous. I've had a couple years ago an Orthodox Jewish student do a thesis on some of the Jewish environmental materials. And some of these Talmudic traditions and so on are just incredibly fine materials. But I think there always has been a deep sense that you keep these because you're a Jew, you don't become a Jew just by keeping them. In other words, even for these kinds of laws and so on that you mention, they really spell out what kind of life one ought to live and what kind of life is possible because you know God's deliverance and God's love. So that I think even there, it isn't just that you know, you're not sure about what life is, you're not sure about God's love, you're anxious and so on, but now if I just keep all these regulations, I'll be okay. Many people do that. I think both Jews and Christians treat ethics that way. I think there's a kind of moralism and a kind of legalism in both cases. But it seems to me that's not at the heart of the tradition. It's the Passover and so on doesn't start with keeping regulations and so on. It starts with this incredible drama of God's deliverance. And so I would say that is true there, even though in some ways Christians have articulated this principle more radically. It seems to me it's still very, very fundamental within Judaism. And one way to think about that, Torah in Judaism is not just legal regulations. Torah is the whole first five books of the Jewish scriptures. So when Jews say, "I love thy law, O Lord," they don't mean just rules. They mean these magnificent stories, these traditions, these incredible events, these teachings about the nature of God. That's what you love. You don't, and I think if people don't understand that broader sense of Torah, it pushes them in a somewhat legalistic direction. Now, there is within Judaism also a conditional form of the covenant. If you keep Torah, God will bless you. And to some extent, that appears also in Christian writings, in cases like the book of James, or sometimes in Christian discussions of judgment. Christians see God's judgment in their lives, not as antithetical to his love, but as a demonstration of his love, almost in the way that a parent who disciplines a child, presumably ought to do it, or ideally does it, because he loves the child. The mother loves the child, the father loves the child, not out of anger. So it's complex, but I think it would roughly fit in something like that. But the individual regulations, rules, principles, and so on, I think are best seen as guidelines, not as a legalistic code. Someone had a yes, and then here. Mm-hmm.
Downplay or speak against the legalistic aspect of Judaism or of any tradition is that you don't necessarily realize what's behind every single, you know, specific law, and then it's almost, I don't know, I think it almost is like a self-paternalistic type of thing that you don't think of, you think of, you know, what they do for God, but, you know, I don't know that it's about proving yourself to God, that there are things about the specific moral imperatives that are meant to better you as a person, and that the whole system and framework can be a very humbling thing, and that, you know, an observant Jew has to understand that they don't necessarily understand the reasons behind every single law, and that there's a greater sort of, you know, way of the world operating, and that you are, you know, working towards some sort of goal.
Wonderfully stated. I fully agree with that, and I think that is not at all inconsistent. Jews see the law as a great treasure, as a great aid to successful living. And I think if you look at the Galatians text, Paul, twice in the book of Galatians, he says, "For neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision, but a new creation." Now, what does he mean? What he means is that he's arguing the Gentile Christians shouldn't have to be circumcised, but he's saying, on the other hand, there's no particular benefit in not being circumcised. You may not be saved by keeping the law, but you're not certainly saved by breaking the law, despising the law. The issue is that law is penultimate, it's not primary. The law is a guide, a help, a way to make us better persons, but it's not the fundamental reality, which is God's deliverance and God's love. So I think you put it very, very well, and that's what I mean by ethical principles as middle axioms or guidelines. They're very, very important.
But I think, I mean, putting it as penultimate, there definitely is a concept, but I just use it from self-eternalism because that's what came into my head.
Sure, sure.
The idea that we don't necessarily know what's, you know, best for us.
Of course, of course.
Lead us to the ideal kind of Sabbath that we would want.
No, I think that's... Did I tell in this class, I can't remember, the experience of finishing up my thesis at Harvard and not being able to write at the end, sort of freezing up. Let me tell you that just briefly, because it's very relevant to this. I was within about 6 weeks of finishing my doctoral dissertation at Harvard at the beginning of the summer of 64, and I got to a point where I began to have writer's block, and for a few days or a week, this didn't bother me much because I'd had this happen before. But after 2 or 3 weeks, I began to get worried. And after about 6 or 7 weeks, I was just panicked. I just literally could not write anymore. And my friends were getting worried. I was worried. My wife was worried. I just froze. I just could not write another word. And I was in the Harvard Widener, Andover Widener Library, the Andover Harvard Library, and I had a table about this size and then a larger sheet of plywood, about 4 by 8 maybe, on top of the table. And one day I was sitting there after about 8 weeks of writer's block. I mean, I was panicked because I just wasn't doing anything. And I was thinking about what was happening, and I suddenly realized that the Harvard PhD had become the ultimate value in my life. It really was an idol. It was functioning like God. This was what I wanted more than anything else. And this hit me with great force. I realized that this really had become my ultimate value. And I can remember very, very clearly when this sort of sunk into me, I just banged my hand down on the table. Some of the people around me, I think, thought I had finally cracked. I said to myself, I'll be damned if I'll let Harvard do this to me. And as soon as I said it, I realized, no, it wasn't Harvard doing it to me. It was me letting this happen. And I also realized that I would be damned, in a way, that that Harvard wasn't a worthy God to worship. And as soon as I...
God plays better hockey.
God plays better hockey. Okay. As soon as I realized that, my immediate reaction was one of freedom and liberation. To hell with Harvard. I'm getting out of here. You know, I've seen the light. Forget the thesis. Forget the PhD. I really see the truth now. Harvard isn't the end of the world. And I was all set to leave and say, forget the PhD. And then in my devotions a day or two afterwards, I was reading in Galatians, and I read, for neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but a new creation. And it suddenly dawned on me that, yes, a Harvard PhD was not the ultimate, but spending the rest of my life bound to Harvard, hating and fighting Harvard, wasn't going to do me any good. Breaking the law, so to speak, fighting this wasn't going to help me any. That the issue was not getting a PhD or not getting a PhD, not serving Harvard or hating Harvard. You can be just as bound to someone when you hate them as when you love them. And I realized I wanted to be a college professor. You needed a union card. So why not sit down like an adult, finish the thesis, and get on? And that's precisely what I did. And so, yes, the law is a wonderful gift. Ethics are a wonderful gift. But it's you certainly don't get any mileage out of being an antinomian, you know, fighting law and rules and principles. That just ties you to the same thing. Does that make any sense? Yes, there was a hand. Rick, you had your hand up, and then Edwina. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Yeah, I was thinking that it might be instructive to consider the difference between being a lawyer and being a faithful servant. A lawyer is concerned with the details of the law and unfortunately often is trying to figure out how he can, his client can do what he wants and still not technically be violating the law.
Right.
But a faithful servant is more interested in the reality behind the law.
Okay. Yeah, and I think we see that in many, many different ways. You know, even if you look at Wealth of Nations, if you look at Adam Smith and so on, there's a lot of morality there. And most of the early theorists on capitalism argue this system isn't going to work at all unless people are moral and basically committed to justice and so on. And I think the kinds of things we've seen the last two or three years in the Wall Street and even now mutual funds and so on, where people are totally committed to their own self-interest and not to the well-being of their clients, they're not serving others, it's a nightmare. Because if people don't start out with some sense of integrity, some sense of being a servant, some sense of other than just keeping the law in a totally legalistic sense, we're in trouble. And so I think the ancient Jewish insight and the Christian insight is get your heart right, or even as Augustine said, it's a radical statement, but I think it embodies some of the same principle, love God and do as you please. Now, that's too radical a statement because Augustine himself realized we needed ethics and so on, but the principle is there. Commit yourself to justice and love of neighbor and so on, just like in a good marriage. In a really good marriage, rules and principles and stuff are useful, but if you're deeply, deeply committed to the other person, there's an enormous freedom. You know, my wife puts up with my singing in the shower and my feeble attempts at poetry and so on. There's enormous freedom because the situation is secure. Edwina?
I was just going to say...
Nice and loud so they can hear in back.
One of the things that I thought was following me in point in the Book of Galatians is it's not so much legalism in terms of like rituals and like modes of living, but it was more the attitude that resulted from the legalism of judging other people. And so like you were thinking that you were better than the person who wasn't wasn't following your rituals. And so in essence, was not what God was, you know, what the whole, like, goal was in God's, like, freedom. It was to look at yourself and not worry about what other people were doing. But, you know, you help your fellow neighbors and you love them.
Okay.
And it wasn't about, like, oh, well, you weren't circumcised, so I'm better than you.
Okay.
You're still good, but I'm better.
Okay. And
that hierarchy.
And this principle ties in very, very nicely with the Niebuhr reading, because one of the fundamental understandings in Judaism and in Christianity is that even the saints are still sinners. You know, one of the scary things about some systems like Marxism is that the people on the inside were so sure they had the truth and so sure they were on the right path that they ran roughshod over millions and millions of people. But Judaism at its best and Christianity at its best, the saints always remember and are constantly reminded that they're still sinners. You know, that there's a huge ambiguity, and just because you keep the law and because you delight in it doesn't mean that you somehow are a superior human being. And I think that theme, which you'll see very clearly in the Niebuhr reading this week, ties in very, very nicely. Now, Christians have often forgotten that. Jews have too sometimes. But ideally, one recognizes, yes, this is the love of God, and yes, my life is better, but I'm not better than other people in some fundamental sense that I'm the saint and they're the sinner. Your comment, we can talk more about that. That was very, very helpful because I think when you see within Judaism, when you see people having this almost childlike pleasure, and that's the wrong term, but it's a kind of delightful pleasure in the law itself. It's a wonderful experience. I think of my grad student who certainly did not think of the law as a burden. She thought of it as the way that helps her live out her love of God. And so that was an extremely helpful comment. Okay.